book that I absolutely have to read anyway. And to actually to get an early copy of it as well on PDF, so you'll see my very marked up copy in my bag. And also just congratulate Stephen on a really, really fine book, I think. It's beautifully written. It's an ethnography, so it's quite compelling in terms of the personal stories it tells, but I think it also speaks to us in a bigger way in terms of trying to understand capitalist dynamics today as well. Because I think, you know, those of you who are in Canada or doing research in other places around the world will find quite relevant. I just want to say a few things about why it's particularly relevant for me. So I'm doing research, I've been doing research in Southeast Asia for more years than I want to say. Thailand has been one of my main focus countries. I speak some of the language. I also work regionally as well. In the last 2 or 3 years, my main focus has been on workers in the fishing industry in Thailand, which are these days about 100,000 workers. From both Myanmar and Cambodia, they're also migrant workers. They switched to the use of migrant workers at about the same time as you described the industrial sector in Thailand did, for similar reasons, to push down the cost of labor, and also because the local workers from the coast, basically with rapid economic growth, before the financial crisis had other options. Even after the financial crisis, they wouldn't go back to the fishing. Fishing owners really were going after the migrant laborers. Workers. So there's a lot about in this book that is very helpful for me, just in terms of the empirical detail. I don't understand the history of the registration of migrant workers and all the details. I think there's some bigger things one can say about that, but it was very helpful for me. There are also some real resonances for me as well in terms of some of the strategies used by the employers in Minnesota and the strategies used by the owners of the fishing boats, who are generally elites in about 20 to 30 ports strung out along the top coast. And their collaborations with local authorities. It's a very similar kinds of things going on. So that's just about me. I wasn't quite sure what Stephen was going to say, so I just want to kind of make a few points about why, about the book, which I think will repeat a little bit of what you said. So just take that as kind of me reinforcing his points, maybe in slightly different words. And I wanted to take as kind of my starting point. Some of you, I think, read the intro. Somewhere fairly near the beginning of the book, Stephen kind of introduces the book by saying something that he said now about how a lot of the literature in political economy sort of understands, for example, the spatial fix, the flexibilization of labor and so on, in almost kind of a straight line approach. And one can debate whether that literature really does or not, but I think there's an argument that, you know, among some people, Harvey and so on, there's a tendency to kind of privilege, I think, these kind of global political economic processes to see what's happening in places like Minnesota as kind of reactive. And he goes on and he says, well, you know, what that does is it hides the kind of fine grains, let me see where it is, it kind of hides the fine grains of what's actually happening on the ground. So the question is, why should we care about those fine grains? Like, what does it really matter in terms of the operation of the global political economy? Why does what Stephen is writing about actually speak to that larger economy? And I think he's kind of answered that. And I'm really just going to run through again some of the ways that he mentioned and maybe a little bit differently. I think the first thing that he does is provincialize a lot of the political economy literature. By provincialize, what I mean is to say is that he's not saying anything is wrong about what's being written in North America, about North America. But North America is just another one area. It doesn't speak to global processes, right? So you need to say Canada, the United States, Europe, these are, it's kind of like, you know, it's just one area. We need to look at things from different perspectives. In this case, the term he uses is the global south. Now, we can ask questions about whether we can generalize the global south. You are kind of doing that a little bit in the book, and I think that's some of the questions one could raise. The bigger point is that we need to provincialize some of this literature to understand it as applying really only to one specific area of the world, and that we need to sort out what's happening in other parts of the world in terms of specific dynamics that are happening there. I think the second point that I really got from this is, for me, this is really not new, but this where it sort of helped me think about my own research now is more on the second point, which is to say that In many ways, work capitalism, global forms of capitalism, to use, he uses a little thing from The Great Arch at one point, which says there's no such thing as capitalism in general, only forms of kind of capital, forms of capital on the ground, right? I love that book, I love that quote as well. So we use that kind of terminology. Forms of capital sort of on the ground, they get produced not just by the operation of capital, but by struggle and worker struggle. And what that does is it says we need to look more closely at struggles and worker struggles. And in particular, in the context of what we might call flexibilization in Thailand, and I'm not even sure it's the best term, right? It works here, I'm not even sure it's the best term for Thailand, but we can talk about that. It's something that will stand in. It does not apply to my fisheries work, by the way. What are the new forms of struggle that emerge in that kind of context where he's working? And I think, and that's in a sense, the point here is that in order to understand the kind of struggles that emerge, you have to look at those fine grains that he's talking about, right? That's the starting point. So where am I on this now? So, and I have to say, in looking at these kind of struggles of workers in this, so it's, one of the things Stephen avoids that he does not do is he doesn't celebrate those worker struggles. The book is full of contradiction, is full of failures, is full of, there's even betrayal and things like that. And so I think it's, you know, in reading the book, you're not going to get a celebration of how wonderful workers are. It's workers who are struggling, having difficulty, making difficult decisions, making the wrong decisions, and so on and so on. I think actually for me, the thing I really got from the book was the methodology and the importance of the methodology he uses to do this research. So one can ask, in order to find the kind of new struggles that are happening today, to find, sort of figure out what they are, how do we go about doing this? And you cannot read this from documents, you cannot read this from, you know, reading corporate annual reports or whatever. What he did is he spent a year in the field. He spent a lot of time working with workers. And the reason this is important is because the sort of material he's talking about is not, you can only do that by hanging out with workers. You can't even get to something by just doing an interview. You kind of have to live their daily lives. So that raises a methodological question. Can we only know about current worker struggles in the context of flexibilization through these kinds of methodologies? Or what kind of methodologies are appropriate? But there's other aspects of the methodologies I kind of want to mention. I'm going to kind of switch quickly to my fisheries work here and show you how what he did kind of translates to what I'm doing. In a sense, when I see workers trying to exercise agencies to improve their working conditions in fisheries, there's really two things that they could do. I mean, it's more than two, but there's a few things that they could do. One of them is exactly what you talked about, which is to change employers, employer mobility. If you don't like that captain, or go work for another captain. Okay. Migrant, and in a sense, so what part of what happens on the part of the capitalists and the authorities is that they do what they can to restrict that mobility. And I'm seeing exactly the same processes going on. This is why, for example, there was a big scandal in Thailand about 3 or 4 years ago around so-called slave labor. These are all about strategies to restrict work mobility because that's how workers can improve their working conditions. So part of my analysis is not, I have to say, you know, those media analyses, I think, were, they really pick on the worst cases of the restriction of mobility. The vast majority of workers are in a better situation than we saw in the media and the New York Times and the Guardian and all these sort of reports. But it's sort of the extreme end of what I think is a broader pattern of worker struggle around the question of mobility. The other way, this is what's really useful for me, is what Stephen does is he looks really carefully at the everyday lives of workers and the kind of social relations they produce. So, for example, they're all working together in a factory, they're all living together in a particular residence, this produces certain kinds of relationships, and out of those relationships come the kinds of solidarities that they're able to produce. So I can take that and I can say, well, what about a fishing boat, okay? People are isolated out there at sea. It's much more difficult to have solidarity kind of across a sector when you're constantly being isolated at sea, right? So this speaks to some of the difficulties fishing workers have. What about in port? They come to port, they're foreign workers, they're receiving great suspicion. A port is a border, by the way, it's a border crossing, so the security agencies are all there. Again, many of these kind of operations come into play. Another kind of strategy that workers can use, which has been more successful in fisheries because it's been the attention, in it's now it's been the focus of global attention, so the slavery scandal, is to kind of appeal to authorities to enforce their regulation. In the case of fishing, this is different from Minnesota. All the NGOs are there, there's inspection centers, the FAO, the ILO, everybody's on this. And I think largely for that reason, the condition, the situation for fishing workers has improved somewhat in the past few years. The last one, and this is the one that's really important to me, is, yeah, okay, to say, what are the kind of collective actions that can come out of basically the spatial and configuration, kind of the spatial praxis and configuration of this kind of thing. And so on. And I think that's, I think the question I'm going to pursue in the future is, actually there's been a number of two organizations have tried to establish, start to establish unions, for example. Unions have their issues, they can be co-opted and so on. But it suggests that there is movement toward a more collective kind of action for people to kind of regulate their workplace environments. And this, to me, it's about regulation, right? How do you kind of regulate working conditions? Who participates? Is it the state that regulates? For example, is it the owner that regulates, or do workers themselves participate in that regulation? Collective agreements are ways of regulating your work conditions that involve the participation of workers. So for me, the methodology of really looking carefully at the spatial praxis, the mobilities, the spatial organizations of work and workplace, and how solidarities can rise up with that, to me, that's one of the things I really got from this book, and that I think I can apply in my research. So I think the big questions for me in terms of questions is really, you know, well, that's nice. We can have all these grains of sand in China and fisheries work in Minnesota. New worker solidarities, people find their, maybe get a better deal from their workers or not. It still raises the question, does it do something to that straight line? And I don't think it's a bit outside the scope of that book, but does it actually revise the way we think about economy, flexibilization, post-Fordism, and the spatial fix and all these sorts of things? Or is it simply, labor's expensive in Korea, we'll move there, and so on? Is it simply kind of reinforced those trends, or do we actually think differently about that? Is this kind of accumulation of many struggles in different places that are not connected to each other? Does this actually add up to something that makes a difference? And I think that would be sort of the big question that I have coming from your book. I have a few other observations, questions, or, the issues of violence and so on that come and relationship to primitive accumulation, but I'm not going to get into that. I would just leave it with a kind of bigger question. And I think the other question that many of you might think about is, how do some of these ideas apply here to Canada? So for example, in my own research, I've been inspired a lot by people working on the agricultural worker programs and the temporary worker programs here in Canada, because many of the same conditions and processes that we find here in Thailand, the limits on employer mobility, the restrictions on unionization and collective action, many of the spatial, all of these sorts of things apply differently, but they also apply in certain kinds of ways here. So what are the sort of solidarities that could emerge out of these kinds of labor regimes that we see here? I think we can use this kind of methodology and think about this in ways as well.